From the Sky News Centre at 5, four people have appeared in court charged with helping to dispose of and hide the body parts of murdered 16-year-old Becky Watts. Our reporter Adele Robinson has the latest from Bristol.
It was just a short hearing lasting a couple of minutes here at Bristol Magistrates. All four defendants are accused of assisting in the disposal and concealment of the body parts of Rebecca Watts with intent to impede the apprehension or prosecution of Nathan Matthews.
Mr. Matthews is Becky's stepbrother. He's in custody, charged with her murder. Broadcasters say they intend to press ahead with plans for three televised leaders' debates during the general election campaign. David Cameron said he only wants to take part in one involving at least seven party leaders. But the news channels want the Prime Minister to rethink his decision, saying a one-to-one debate with Ed Miliband is important. Leader of the Green Party, Natalie Bennett, thinks the broadcasters are doing the right thing.
What they finally came up with, the 772 model, was very fair. Mr. Cameron, with his stance, is really doing even further damage to trust in British politics. We need to move on.
A mother and her girlfriend have been jailed for more than 30 years between them for torturing and killing an 8-year-old girl. Polly Chowdhury and Kiki Mudder have been sentenced to 13 and 18 years respectively for the manslaughter of Chowdhury's daughter, Aisha Ali. Drivers are going to be given a 10-minute grace period after a parking ticket expires. The changes, which come into force in England within the next few weeks, mean drivers will no longer be fined if they're slightly late coming back to their cars. US investigators say they'll look into Harrison Ford's air crash in Los Angeles. Onlookers saw the actor's plane come down on a golf course after one of his engines failed. He's in hospital but should make a full recovery. In sport, Katarina Johnson-Thompson has won her first major athletics title. She broke the British record to claim gold in the pentathlon at the European Athletics Indoor Championships. She only just missed out on a world indoor record. That's the latest. I'm Emma Jones.
BCFM. It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Tony Gosling helping me review this week's news. It's Conservative Deputy Mayor on George Ferguson's Cabinet, Councillor for Westbury on Trim, Jeff Gollop. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Mohamed Emwazi was a good Muslim lad until MI5 got him and turned him into a crazed killer. We hear Emwazi describe MI5's efforts to turn him in his own words, raising the question, is Britain's prevent strategy worth a thing? Also, the UK had an agent in Al-Qaeda who was one of the founders of the organisation. He's been speaking out on the BBC this week. And the secret history of HSBC. Never mind the tax evasion, the LIBOR fixing, the foreign exchange fraud or the money laundering. Tonight, we look at how the Vietnam War was nothing to do with communism and everything to do with the heroin trade. And we go back hundreds of years to look at opium smuggling by the British East India Company with US publisher Chris Mulligan. His late father worked in Indochina alongside US Colonel Lansdale for the CIA. Plus more from the band Reverend Stephen Sizer. Remember him from Virginia Water? This time he talks about a breakdown of the modern medieval-style heresy that's so popular in the United States, that is Christian Zionism. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots, also looking at Boris Nemtsov killing this time last week in Moscow. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 degrees Celsius and dry and mild. This weekend, temperatures up to 14 Celsius, warmer with sunny spells on Saturday, cooler with some showers, though, on Sunday. Next week, highs of 14 Celsius, wet and windy on Monday, but the rest of the week, plenty of sunny spells. Next weekend, 14th and 15th of March, highs of 14, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's rather more cheery two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Now spring is here. And time now to introduce our guest, who's Conservative Deputy Mayor on George Ferguson's Cabinet. That's Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, Jeff Gollop. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Danny. Thank you.
First of all, being a Deputy Mayor, how does the role work between you being on the Cabinet and having a separate Conservative leader?
I'm in the Cabinet. I work with George. And the rest of my Cabinet colleagues, which is an interesting experience, with four different parties actually working together to try and get the best outcomes we can. And there's a delicate balance between that and working with my group leader. But in fact, given that we're all aiming to try and do the best we can for Bristol, actually, there's not a great deal of conflict.
Well, but surely, I mean, in the Cabinet, it's all a bit of a waste of time. Do you ever wonder why you're there sometimes? Because George doesn't have to listen to you at all, does he? The way it works now is we elect the councillors, but the councillors don't have the power. George does.
I can't disagree with you, but what I can say is I've been a councillor for 14 years, and I've been in the third group on council every one of those 14 years, and all I've ever been able to do is argue and lobby and campaign for the things I believe in and my constituents
believe
in. Well,
that's because Bristol's not a conservative city, is it? I mean, most of the MPs are not conservatives either.
It's actually not about politics with a capital P. It's about what's good for our communities. So actually, working together, trying to get the best thing you can, often involves working cross-party. Sadly, the bit you see make the headlines is all the stage-managed party political bickering, but it's not actually the goodwill of working together to try and achieve the best outcomes.
What's your thoughts about how it's been working with the mayor, though? Because, I mean, you're very closely in with him. I'm expecting you to say, oh, we think George is wonderful. But do you?
Most of the time, I think George is wonderful. I think he does a good job. I stood against him in the mayoral elections. And I can look at it and see that it's, in fact, it's an impossible job for any one person to do, because you will never satisfy majority of the electorate at any one time. He has a vision of where he wants to go and what he wants to achieve for Bristol, and I've always believed that actually, even if I don't disagree, I don't agree with someone's vision, I'd rather they were doing it firmly and carrying out and making something happen for the good of the city. I'm afraid compromise isn't the best way of achieving what this city needs. And the city is now vibrant. There is building going on. There are jobs being created. And the city is very much open for business.
Well, hang on a minute, Jeff, because you go to St Paul's. There isn't, is there? There's not building going on. There's a vast area there. It must be at least 10 acres of rubble that's been there for about 3 or 4 years, owned by Places for People, the social housing people, and nothing's getting built at all. So it may be all nice and rosy up in Clifton, but not in St Paul's.
I'm not suggesting it's all rosy up in Clifton, and there's an awful lot of work still needs doing. One of the areas I have a concern about, I see as a really top priority, is our housing strategy. I mean, it's, you know, the city needs affordable housing, and the city's well-being will suffer if we do not provide the accommodation for those we need to work in the city to be able to afford to live here.
You've just said about the building going up, but it's not the things that we need building, which is the affordable housing. The offices are going up, luxury flats are going up, but not what we need.
We need a mixture of all. We need the offices going up because that creates the jobs that create the wealth that make the work the rest possible.
Well, no, I'll tell you what happens when the offices go up, Jeff. I have to disagree with you there. Is people move out of existing offices into the nice new ones, and then we get left with more empty offices.
There is an issue with some of the older offices that have been empty for some time. And I'm not happy with this at all, some are being converted into student accommodation, and I would love to see us championing a policy of converting offices into residence accommodation rather than student accommodation.
I've asked this for to guests over the last few weeks because of the slow slide of Bristol 24/7, which is a local news website. Chris Brown, who was the chief sub at the Western Daily Press, set that up about 4 years ago. It's now been really wrestled from him by investors, Dougal Templeton and Mike Bennett, who've invested into it. And I would say constructively dismissed him, really, by putting someone who's a cafe reviewer above him as editor. What's your thoughts generally about the health of the media in the city? I'm talking really more, I suppose, about things like the Bristol Post, the BBC and ITV.
I think that I certainly have a concern that the Evening Post has downsized the number of journalists it has. In other parts of the country, the local paper's gone to weekly. And I fear that the Post could be into that spiral.
Yeah, we've seen that with the Bath Chronicle. That was a few years ago, wasn't
exactly.
It?
And we know that ITV and BBC are looking at staff numbers and so on. And I consider a strong media is essential to effective government, because it provides a way of challenging, of questioning, and covering what happens. And therefore, it worries me if we do not have a free and independent and thriving media.
Yeah, because it's quite an important job, spending that £350 million, I think it is, a year of our money that the council does. I mean, do you ever feel that there are questions that you're raising about the way that money's being spent that aren't being reflected in the press?
I have thought that in the past when I was a backbench councillor. Of course, I'm entirely happy now with the way the process works. But I do believe that good scrutiny of backbench councillors probing and asking questions is also a key part. But one actually ultimately has to have people in the media who understand the issues and are prepared to cover them and confront them, as I know you do on this programme and at other occasions throughout the week. And that is absolutely vital, that local councillors and indeed employees of the council as well as councillors are held to account.
Well, they're managers and editors as well at these various institutions, and they've got to create the right atmosphere where journalists are able to challenge things and don't feel that there's any pressure on them to say keep the mayor sweet or anything like
that. Absolutely. I mean, I have to say, you know, one of the things that surprises me with the Post is the fact that every day now the front page is a picture with a headline and not a story, and that seems to me to be a pity, because that is potentially the most powerful page on the paper.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I think there is pressure, isn't there? There's bound to be in the financial crisis on newspapers. What's happening, of course, is that much of the advertising spend is going online now. And anyway, businesses don't have so much to spend on advertising. So there's bound to be, in the commercial press, as well as the BBC, some pressure downward. And we've also had this review last week, I believe it came out, into the future of the BBC, maybe the week before, into the future of the BBC, where the government are now questioning whether there should be this licence fee, whether that should continue long term into the future.
Well, obviously, having a varied and pluralistic press is a key part of a functioning democracy. And like much else in our society, I'm afraid, money doesn't talk, it swears. And, there is far too much concentration of media ownership. Rupert Murdoch has far too much power already. And of course, with the BBC is successfully nobbled, then he will move into that vacuum. That's definitely his strategy.
I mean, what's being said is that the BBC licence fee will carry on for another decade, but they're talking about something called the BBC charge. So the idea is moving away from the traditional form. Now, this, of course, is what Rupert Murdoch wants, Jeff, isn't it?
I fear so. I know it makes for a bad programme, but I'm going to agree with Martin. You know, you can't have that much power in the hands of one person and a group of companies they operate dictating the policies and views. And I say that I'm not sure whether I'm more concerned when they're dictating policies that support my views or dictating policies that oppose them. But either way, it is wrong that the media is directing the way people should vote and hold opinions. They should be reporting the opinions that people hold and not the other way around.
Also, we've had this week massive story in the national press about Bristol, very negative, unfortunately, which is the unfortunate demise of Becky Watts. What's your thoughts about the way that's played out over the last couple of weeks, Jeff?
Well, it's almost impossible to express an opinion because it is depressing in the extreme that we all live in a city where someone who can conduct themselves in the way it appears the killers have conducted themselves lives as well. I just find it extraordinary. I've always had the belief that you treat other people the way you want to be treated yourself, and I understand that people can have problems, they can have issues, family problems can develop into things that spiral out of control, but one cannot begin to comprehend what has gone on in that family and can only feel enormous sadness at what the rest of that family must be going through at the moment.
And we've heard, Martin, today four more have been charged. Obviously, there are charges. We don't know for sure what's happened. There's been lots of rumours over the last couple of weeks. But ultimately, it looks like the police have done their job here, doesn't it?
Well, yes, because it sounds as if it's a kind of crime passionnel, as it were. So, therefore, it's not really a professional crime by professional criminals. But nevertheless, what does strike me as very strange is that people have been involved in disposing of the body, a variety of people. And that's probably why the police have been able to catch them, because if you go around asking people, can you help me dispose of a body, then word's going to leak out about it. We'll all find out in the fullness of time what happened. And of course, everybody's just very sad about it. A young life just taken needlessly like that.
Yeah, so just point out again that those charged, we've got no idea whether they were even involved, let alone guilty.
Well, exactly. We should suspend judgment until we get full facts, shouldn't we?
Yes, but I mean, this has happened, of course, in a quite deprived area of the city, Barton Hill, apparently, according to the police. Jeff, it does seem like we've got a bit of a divide, and in fact, that actually reflects something which is going on right across the country, as we've seen over the last few years, an extreme gap opening up between the rich and the poor. And I mean, there's no reason why this couldn't possibly have happened in Clifton, but I do point to the fact that these deprived areas, I mean, there's all sorts of pressures on families that aren't there in wealthy areas, aren't there?
Well, I mean, there was the sad murder in Clifton a couple of years ago, so I think there are all sorts of issues in terms of deprived areas, but I think this is about... this is about respect for human life and respect for each other, and that ultimately should transcend whatever background. You know, we have to deal with those different issues of wealth and health that have arisen, but at the end of the day, one can't make any apology or excuse for what's gone on in this situation.
Absolutely right. Also, move on to some news this week, the UK household incomes near pre-banking crisis levels. Now, this looks more positive, doesn't it? And maybe you can answer this one, Martin. This is the Institute for Fiscal Studies earlier this week has been saying that actually things are looking pretty good. After the longest decline in living standards this century, the fortunes of Britain's workers have turned, with the average household ending the financial year in April better off than they were in 2008, according to a leading think tank. In a huge pre-election boost for the government, the Institute for Fiscal Studies said average incomes in 2014-15 are around the same level as they were in 2007-2008, before the banking crisis precipitated a deep recession. And this is not the Daily Telegraph, this is The Guardian, Martin.
Well, I mean, the point one would make about that is that this is a very unusual recession. Previous recessions that we've suffered in my lifetime, and I'm 55, by this stage of the game, the economy has usually bounced back to a level higher than it was before the initial crash. And the other real problem, which is not even a party political problem, is it's all based on money printing in the US and Britain and zero interest rates, which are not normal at all. and ultimately will have to be reversed. And the problem is that any rise in interest rates here or in the US is likely to tank out the economy. And that's not really a problem. It's a problem for the British government, but it's not just a British government problem. The global financial system, which is based in Britain, is actually still in a very, very seriously ropey state. And I'm afraid much of the electoral debate is happy talk, really, because the situation is actually very dire and nobody really wants to address that.
This is some pretty good news for you, Jeff, isn't it? I mean, for the Conservatives. It's almost as if this is like a little bit of magic just before the election. Some good news on the economy.
It clearly is good news on the economy, and it's probably even better news if one looks at the economic situation in many of our fellow European countries and the levels of unemployment and the general economic climate in those countries. But I don't think there is any cause for major celebration at this stage, because we have quite a number of issues that still need to be addressed. The number of people who are working but claiming benefits is actually significantly higher. We have clear issues with the need to look at paying a living wage so that those who are earning can actually afford to live on what they earn and not need a subsidy from the state to cover the fact that they're not being paid enough. So we've got a significant number of issues that still need to be dealt with. Now, I feel much happier that the number of people employed is going up, and therefore that means there is more contribution in terms of tax and national insurance going into the national economy, which hopefully enables us to be in a situation that we can help those most in need. But there's a long, long way to go.
Well, I'll tell you where that long, long way to go is, particularly. Figures from the study show that the median income for young adults aged 22 to 30 was projected to be 7.6% lower in 2014 to 15 than 2007 to 2008, and 2.5% lower for those aged 31 to 59. Those aged 60 and over fared much better, enjoying 1.8% rise. So this is hitting the young, just as the tuition fees, just as the unemployment figures, more than ever. Now, what are we going to do? Because these people are our future.
They are. I this is more a personal view than a political view, and I'd be controversial and say I think we are looking at trying to educate too many of our young people to university level rather than actually looking at providing vocational qualifications which can actually be of use to them in getting employment. And I think that's a challenge that we need to address. And you know, one's hearing the stories now that we, you know, well, classic example, we can't get enough bus drivers. And actually, we need to look at how we train, and we have to stop creating an atmosphere that you have to go to university to prove you're eligible for whatever. Actually, someone with a vocational qualification who can go out and build, plaster, plumb, whatever, actually is much more important to our society, and we've got to change our attitudes.
Well,
I'll tell you how you get
a bus driver is you up the wages. It's pretty simple. There's plenty of people out there who would do the job, I'm sure, or train to do the job if they thought that they were going to get more of a living wage. Anyway, Martin.
Well, on the bus driving, I think one of the problems is the split shifts. People I've spoken to who've been bus drivers say one of the real problems is you go out early in the morning, you then go home, lie down, and then you've got to go out again in the evening. And that really makes a mess of people's social lives. So you've got to compensate them for that by paying them wages that can compensate them for it. I think there are obviously questions about training that we need to address. I think the real fundamental problems, not just in the British economy but in the global economy, haven't really been addressed. We've had 5 years of quantitative easing, 5 years of zero interest rates, and the economy's kind of picked up a bit. We've still lost our credit rating. If you remember, Britain lost its credit rating in the early phases of the government when they were pursuing austerity one. I think it's all very fragile. If the Greeks, for example, next week decide to walk away from the euro, then the banking system of Europe will collapse. That's how dangerous this all is. If the war in Ukraine flares up, that could cause a crash. If the Chinese economy takes a dive, then that will cause a crash. There's so many possibilities of things going badly wrong, and not just because of mismanagement by the coalition government, although there's been an element of that. I think we're going to have to face up to the fact that a lot of the things we've been doing just haven't been enough, and there's going to be a very, very big social crisis just around the corner.
Well, the thing is, we've got a chance to change it all in May, haven't we? Thank goodness, this year.
I don't think... You see, this is the point I'm trying to make, Tony, is that whoever the government is, these major problems, of structural problems with the financial services sector, are not going to go away.
Well, we'll see if some of that comes out in some of these TV debates that are going to be happening.
But you see, it's interesting you're saying that, because... Actually, the one thing in local government that the recognition is that actually whoever forms the government post and the 7th of May, we are going to find financial pressures in reduction of our funding. And whilst I have my very own hopes and aims for who's going to form a government, one has to look from a council point of view and see that actually... The pressures are going to continue.
Yes, because other things have been ring-fenced, haven't they? Government has been... Everything's been dumped on local government, hasn't it?
Exactly. And, of course, it's a lot easier for people in Westminster to make cuts that are one removed from them than it is to actually deal with it.
So do you think the cuts maybe wouldn't be there if Bristol was a Conservative city?
No. That could not make any difference, because there is a formula, however confusing and complex that formula is, Bristol would still have the same financial...
Perish the thought. Well, the formula has been
manipulated. I think we have to... The biggest cuts have been in Liverpool, the smallest cuts have been in East Dorset, because the formula's been manipulated. But then, there you go.
Okay. Now, let's have a look at a story which has been popped into the news this week in the Bristol Post about you, Jeff. Bristol's deputy mayor has opposed... Although there are several deputy mayors, aren't there?
No, is it just one? I'm the only deputy. The rest are assistants.
Okay, yep. So it's a little bit like the chief constable and the deputy chief constable and assistant chief constable now in the cabinet. Yep. So Bristol's deputy mayor, that's Jeff, who we're chatting to now, has opposed plans by the city council to close seven libraries, save money and modernise the service. The city council needs to slash £1.1 million from its library budget because it wants to build an arena, I think, by Temple Meads, by 2016 to 17, and 40 jobs are under threat. Mayor George Ferguson approves of the plans, but his deputy Jeff said it doesn't reflect users' wishes. Well, of course it doesn't. I mean, we use libraries, we need libraries. What's going on here, Jeff?
Well, the original proposal was to review the library service to save costs. And I certainly accept that local government isn't always the most efficient organisation, and that there are ways of redesigning services and actually often improving the service, but and providing it at lower cost. And I could see that that was a possibility. And although I was concerned when the proposals were made originally, and I raised questions about library closures then, I was assured that this was only about redesigning the service. But lo and behold, after 3 months of consultation, the proposals come out that we are going to close seven libraries.
Let me just list them. Clifton, Redland, Eastville, Seamills, Marksbury Road in Bedminster, Westbury and Wick Road in Brislington. These are ones that they're talking about closing.
Yep. And two of those, Westbury and Redland, happen to be two of the busiest libraries in Bristol. So you're taking out significant numbers of users who will not, for the most part, go anywhere else. And in all seven cases, those libraries are key parts of our community. Now, I have a vested interest because, as you said, I'm councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, and I ultimately want to work with my local community to protect their services.
But, look, what I want to know is, what on earth are we even considering spending, £90 million or something, on this venue for pop stars, the arena down by Temple Meads, and not on community facilities like libraries, which you know, is are there as a sort of basic essential to make sure that people have got somewhere where they can educate themselves if they wish to, and also get access to newspapers, get access to the internet. I mean, a lot of these services which people are told that you have to use the internet for, you can really only get at a library if you don't have the internet at home. So we've got a complete mismatch. Yeah,
it's not a libraries or arena choice, and one the arena is a capital spend. The libraries are much more a revenue spend. But yeah, if I just take my own library, it has 4,000 regular users, and a quarter of those are over 60. So that library provides a reason for those people to get up and go into that library to take out books, to use reference material, or whatever. Now, I've already had contact with a number of my residents who simply say, look, if that library goes, I'm not capable of getting to another library. I won't be able to get there. And that library provides part of the reason for them to keep going. So, actually, it is about what gives succour to a key part of our, a key proportion of our residents. One only has to look at the number of youngsters that use a library. And I think, yeah, the important thing is that you mentioned a library provides an opportunity for those who may not otherwise have the chance to read and to learn and to enjoy books. And what's made me so angry is that the council talked about looking at different ways of presenting and ended up with the traditional local government approach of actually decimating the service. And I can see that in 1 to 2 years' time, they will review the service again, discover that less people are using it than now because they've closed some popular libraries, discover that the costs have gone up, and decide that they've got to close some more.
Well, so are you going to be able to stop these closures?
I am not certain that I'm going to be able to stop it, but I'm going to give a good, darn good try at trying to work out ways of ensuring that we can carry on providing library services in, hopefully, all of those communities that we looked that the council's currently proposing to remove them from.
Well, just to explain this business of revenue and capital spend, because as far as I can see, it's the same money, it's our money, and whether you spend it on something which you think is going to bring a capital spend which will bring a return in the future, it doesn't make all that much difference when it comes to actually closing a building, a library. Suddenly there's a resource that was capital spending was spent on it in the past, and then it's all that money was wasted if you're not using it.
Yep. The thing is that the council has a set amount of income coming in each year, and the budget can determine how we spend that money. And we can either spend it on paying salaries of staff who work, or on heating and lighting buildings or repairing buildings, or we can spend it on paying interest on money we borrowed for capital projects. And we can't therefore just keep on and on borrowing money. We can't borrow money.
Yeah, but you're borrowing for the arena, for example.
Yeah, we can't borrow money to pay wages. We can borrow money to build buildings. And that is a priority that has to be determined. There is a strong groundswell of opinion that says that the arena is important. I am to believe the arena is important because I think it we are the only major city in the UK that doesn't have an arena and a venue for events of that nature. And it's a sad reflection that Bristol doesn't have an arena. It's the one that doesn't have a modern public transport system. We've missed out on all those opportunities, and we have to actually be prepared to borrow the money to ensure that Bristol is of a parallel standing with the other big
cities. But the arena is not actually a public service like a library is, does it? If just to walk into the arena, you need to pay money to walk in there to do whatever is going on in there. In a library, you don't. You go into a library because you're not having to... There's no ching-ching as you walk over the door. The idea is that knowledge that's in those books and the internet is there for nothing.
And that's why I feel I feel passionately about it and want to do everything I can to create an opportunity of retaining those libraries.
Martin, I mean, libraries are, to be fair, going a bit out of fashion, aren't they, as more people use the internet?
Well, I'm a very big library user. I certainly would miss the libraries if they were closed, although I tend to use the central library, to be honest. But I understand only 6% of the population use the libraries. Those who do use it value it greatly, but large numbers of people don't use it. And I suppose you could argue in those circumstances it's something we can't perhaps afford. I think ultimately we've got to ask ourselves what our values as a society are. Big questions. I don't think we are going to ask these questions until people confront the fact that as I said earlier, the financial services sector is bankrupt. It's insolvent. And we've covered that up through government intervention over the last 5 years, but we're not going to be able to cover it up for much longer. And then we really will have to ask ourselves what sort of society we want to live in and how we're going to allocate resources.
Take that point from Martin there, because he's talking about the billions. I think it's something like 600 billion altogether bailout of the banks. People looking at Royal Bank of Scotland and Lloyds, crossing their fingers, saying, well, we do hope that the government owned shares, we can sell them and we can make some money, even though those shares have gone massively down in price since Gordon Brown effectively bought them back in 2008. So we're going to afford these billions to bail out the banks who made such a mess of things in the run-up to 2008. Mm-hmm. Why can't we afford to keep a library open, for God's sake?
Well, it's you're getting into the realms of the sort of economics that is certainly impossible for, I think, most of us to begin to comprehend. Because Martin also mentioned quantitative easing, which is a concept of government spending large amounts of money to buy, it seems to me, the loans that they've previously made to people, or people have made to them, rather. Mm. Totally incomprehensible. And the basic economic issue that I understand is that if the government simply lent more money to invest in our local infrastructure, the perceived theory is that would create inflation. That's the reason why they won't do
it. That's interesting, Martin. What do you make of that?
Well, I think there has been inflation. There's been inflation in asset prices, effectively. Mm-hmm. When you see, property prices rising and asset prices rising, that is inflation, mm-hmm. but we don't think of it as inflation, although it in fact is. I think the fundamental, what we could and should have done probably, is invested in infrastructure, in people, in training and so on, and then the banks would have been supported, but only at second remove. But I think what we've done is we've bailed out the banking system, which is already, in serious moral hazard. And, of course, that moral hazard has not been in any way removed. And they're quite capable of taking big risks, and they've taken even more. The derivatives market now is bigger than before the crash in 2008, and the stock markets around the world are at the highest levels ever. I mean, that should be ringing alarm bells, actually. But, of course,
and
it doesn't.
Organisation was that was so good at reinventing and inventing new kinds of derivatives? Enron.
Indeed.
And look what happened to them. Mm. And also the accountants that signed off their accounts. The difference with the financial crash, it occurs to me, because I was watching a terrific film, actually. It's called The Smartest Guy in the Room, a documentary about what happened to Enron last week. Mm. And it is that Arthur Andersen, who were the accountants to Enron, actually completely lost their reputation overnight because of the collapse of Enron in the US. The only thing is, companies like KPMG, etc., that signed off the accounts of the big banks in the run-up to the 2008 crashes, all this is wonderful, where actually there were massive black holes in their accounts, they're still going strong. In fact, the big four are stronger than ever, even though there was an inquiry. Well, I think it was the Competition Commission looked into them. They're stronger than ever.
Yeah, if you actually look, the other thing is looking at what happened when Gordon Brown was spending money He was spending all the income the government was receiving in those 10 good years between 1997 and 2007. And that is the time when that money should have been spent on infrastructure that would actually have restored the community assets within the country and would have actually produced something worthwhile. I mean, if you go back, you know, in biblical times, it was actually that you provided in the good years for the bad years that were going to come. And Gordon, bless him, had believed that he'd beaten the economic cycle. No one can beat the economic cycle. That is the most frightening thing. And looking at the figures of what happened to public sector borrowing at the time the collapse hit.
I think that's contentious, frankly. I think you could argue that at the margin they overborrowed. But the real problem was the collapse of the Lehman Brothers in the US, mm-hmm. and the subprime market. And the real problem, really, is the whole derivatives market.
Mm-hmm. Which is still there.
Brooksley Bourne, who was the head of the SEC in the US, when derivatives were starting to come into fashion, she said, well, we should just ban these things. Which is ban them.
Okay.
She was removed.
Okay, we've got a decision time coming up with the general election. If you've managed to get registered to vote, because I was hearing on the way in actually on another radio channel, I think it was a Radio Wales or something, there's 1 million people less registered to vote now because of new rules to do with students and things like that. So you have to really make sure you are registered to vote for the general election if you want to cast your vote. Get on the case. Although I actually called up the city council to ask for a form in the post. So that I could register to vote, and they said, yes, we'll send you one in the post. 3 weeks later, still nothing's arrived in the post from the city council helping us to vote. So that's definitely not, you know, smart. You know, I'd like to see the city council actually deliver leaflets and forms or whatever. If you actually want to vote, so that you can vote, that would be nice. And I'll keep listeners informed on whether we actually do get anything through the post. We do have an election coming up, a general election. One of the interesting things in the run-up to that is this new flavour of these TV debates. Some of them are going to be quite big with lots of different parties. Maybe the Ulster Unionists, maybe not. I don't think Sinn Féin are going to be in
them. The DUP, not the Ulster Unionists.
Is Sinn Féin going to be in these?
No, they probably won't. I don't know. I haven't seen them.
But, I mean, you know, there's all sorts of interesting minor parties that could take part, which will be really interesting to see what comes out. That's where I think you get some really good discussion, is when you've got people who are coming from completely outfield rather than the two main parties. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday, where Ed Miliband confronted David Cameron about apparent reluctance to do a one-to-one TV debate with Ed Miliband.
The broadcasters have proposed a live head-to-head debate between the Prime Minister and me on the 30th of April, a week before polling day. I will be at that debate. Will he be at that debate?
It is all about leadership, Mr. Speaker, and we see no leadership from the party opposite. What's interesting, Mr. Speaker, we're having a debate now, and they cannot talk about the economy. They can't talk about jobs because there are more jobs being created. They can't talk about growth because growth is going up. They can't even talk about living standards because of the breakthrough report today showing living standards are back at their pre-crisis peak. I say, let's have these debates. Let's get on with them before the election.
Well, he says that. That's the Prime Minister David Cameron, Jeff. But why is he not prepared to do this one-to-one debate with Ed Miliband? It does sound like he's chickening out.
I certainly don't think he's chickening out. I can only say from my experience of these sort of hustings debates, they can be fairly unconstructive in their approach. But nevertheless, if he were to phone up and ask me, and that's not a very high possibility, but if he were, I'd actually be saying to him, for goodness sake, go for it, because he's got a fantastic track record to campaign on and argue on.
I mean, one wonders whether his PR people are saying to him, well, actually, you're a liability, David.
No, I suspect they're saying you're ahead on a lot of the economy issues and a lot of the key policy issues, and you don't need to get into that sort of political dogfight.
So he's not sort of a cut-and-burn Prime Minister that's already looking at some nice job in the city that he's going to step into after he leaves politics?
That wouldn't have crossed my mind. I can't think that anyone would go into the role and suffer the challenges and grief that they have in the role of cabinet minister or prime minister if their sole aim was on leaving afterwards. That may not mean that some in the past have not gone on to make some very significant sums.
No, Mr. Blair.
I wasn't thinking of Mr. Blair at all when I said that. But I would not, even with Mr. Blair, be cynical enough to suggest that that was the only reason he went into it in the first place.
But then maybe he changed his mind halfway through. Anyway, Martin, what are your thoughts about this? Because this is a big one, isn't it? It would be quite an interesting debate between Cameron and Miliband on telly.
I think what's behind this is Linton Crosby, the dirty digger who got Tony Abbott.
He's this Australian.
He's the Australian spin doctor who's been brought in. And he's made quite a few errors, in my view. For example, he was the one that came up with the brilliant idea of sending the trucks around asking illegal immigrants to hand themselves in, if you remember, which, of course, Nigel Farage immediately then suggested was a rather un-English manoeuvre, as well he might, but that was quite good politics by Farage, I think. Linton Crosby is out of his depth dealing with British politics. I think that's the truth of the matter.
Jeff, what we're looking at here in the run-up to the general election is actually a debate, supposed debate, with only one person, Ed Miliband, in there, and actually literally an empty chair.
Well, that may be, this may be the outcome, which of course may happen, is that Miliband will just get a free run.
It's not really in the spirit of a general election, Jeff, is it?
It's not in the best interests of an open debate. And as I say, I would certainly be advocating go in there and have the debate.
I mean, my feeling is, it's just like there's a failing trust from the electorate in politicians when things like this happen. And this was something which was brought up at Prime Minister's Questions by Labour MP Seema Malhotra.
Seema Malhotra,
Mr. Speaker, Labour. We all know the Prime Minister trebled tuition fees. Will he today rule out increasing them again?
I tell you what we have done is we've created a system where the universities are now better funded than others in Europe. The number of students going to university has increased and the number of people from poor backgrounds has gone up as well. And we have, from the party opposite, they've taken 4 years to work out their policy. And their policy, it hits universities, helps rich students rather than poor ones, and also it does nothing to expand university education in our country. It's going to be paid for by additional pension taxes on senior nurses, military figures, firefighters. They have spent 4 years to come up with a completely useless policy. It is, if you like, a monument to the chaos you'd get under a Labour government.
Well, Martin, David Cameron there's talking about Labour's policy. And actually, the trouble is, Labour cannot afford to do... I mean, we've had this trebling of tuition fees, but Labour hasn't got the money and cannot afford to reverse it, can it?
Well, I mean, if they do reduce... I mean, the policy,
they'd like to, but...
No, the policy is to reduce it to the fees to 6,000. And, of course, the university is then asking the question, well, how are we going to fund ourselves? That's been a problem for the fees all along, the whole fees policy, by any party, because, as they've always said, you don't have to pay if you don't reach a certain standard of living. And, of course, if there is a further crash, many graduates will never reach the standard of living where they'll pay this money back, and the university will then have a big hole in their budget. But that's one of the problems. But if there is a crash, and I'm afraid there is going to be, everybody's going to be bankrupt. Universities, banks, hospitals, the lot.
Well, maybe, maybe not. Jeff, your thoughts then on this whole business of... I mean, again, of course, this tuition fee increase, tripling of tuition fees, again, it's hit the young, hasn't it?
It has hit the young, and having a couple of children, one just graduated and one at university, I'm very much aware of the issues, and I think it would be wrong, and it will be wrong, if it precludes those who are most able to go to university from going because they're afraid of taking loans. But I come back to the comment I made earlier. It's the question of, do we need to be funding so many universities? And I think this is an issue we have to question, because if one looks, I think you will find that there are a significant number of our new graduates who are unable to get themselves a job because they haven't got the qualifications that are needed. So we really have to question our priorities and how we work.
Yesterday's Daily Mirror: shock 20-year life expectancy gap between the rich and the poor. Experts say the gulf is the same as between Canada and Botswana and shows the shocking inequality that blights modern Britain. People in rich parts of the country enjoy healthy lives for nearly 20 years longer than those in poor areas. Average healthy life expectancy, the length of time till someone gets sick, is just 52 years for children in deprived parts of Britain compared with 71 in rich areas, Martin. This is getting to be quite an enormous gap between the rich and the poor. Being poor can take 20 years off your life.
Well, there's always been gaps. It's not a new thing, but I think in my youth, as it were, from the 60s, 70s and so on, the gap was closing. And of course, what's happened with the kind of free market counter-revolution of the 1980s and subsequently, not just in Britain but all over the world, this gap's got bigger. I mean, Oxfam did a study the other day that showed that a very small percentage of the world's population actually own a huge proportion of the world's wealth. And of course, the thing about quantitative easing, coming back to that, is what it does is it protects the assets of the asset-owning classes. That's what it does. And of course, the theory is that they will then trickle down to the poorer people. But it's actually a political decision. If you were to follow a free market policy, as recommended by the real Hayekians at the von Mises Institute and so on, and I read a lot of their stuff, I don't agree with it all, but it's quite interesting to read, you let the banks collapse, which means wealthy people, say Rupert Murdoch, has to lose his money. And you said, well, why should I lose my money? You had it in the wrong bank. You lose it all.
Jeff, the UK is one of the most unequal countries now in the developed world. Raged, they use that word, the Mirror. Duncan Exley, the director of the Equality Trust. This is damaging our health, our social bonds and our economy.
Well, I think you can play all sorts of arguments in terms of division and the nature of our communities. What I find as far as Bristol is concerned and always have felt is that the health inequality is unacceptable, and one of the things we have to do is reduce that gap. Now, the last figures I saw in Bristol suggested there was a 10-year gap rather than a 20-year gap, but to be honest, I'm not going to argue about 10 years because it's the principle that's wrong. And we have to look at the ways we can improve, and I come back to affordable housing being one of those ways of improving. And if you go back one stage further, early years nursery provision is another opportunity and a key way of providing and improving the lot of children at the very start of their lives. So those are key factors, and we've got to work on and build up our strategy to ensure that we reduce that difference, because it is entirely unacceptable.
Well, fingers crossed, eh? We've got the Scottish Daily Record, a story from them, actually. I think it's the first, isn't it? But that's because they broke the story of a chap called Douglas McWilliams. George Osborne's advisor quits after claims he smoked crack cocaine in a drugs den. This was in the Daily Mail, I think, the day afterwards. But the 63-year-old will step down as executive chairman of the Centre for Economic and Business Research after the Sunday Mirror revelations. But they obviously got an arrangement with the Sunday Herald in Scotland. Douglas McWilliams, 63, will quit as executive chairman of the Centre for Economic and Business Research after the Mirror revealed he was caught on video taking the drug, crack cocaine. He said he was taking time off to deal with issues I've not had the chance to address fully. Apparently he's going to return in August. The video of Professor McWilliams, who last year estimated we would all be £165 a year better off by the time of the election, is seen inhaling the drug through a glass tube at a flat in North London. He then slumped, dazed on a sofa after repeatedly smoking on the makeshift crack pipe involving a miniature Martel cognac bottle. Red-faced and slurring his speech, he later told the dealer he had too much and that he had spent the day on a binge. Two rocks of the deadly drug can clearly be seen on a table beside the dazed professor. Now, this is some guy who's he's actually executive chairman of this thing called the Centre for Economic and Business Research. I suppose I should ask you first, Martin. I mean, you know, this is supposed to be some kind of official organisation that's telling us how the economy's going, and this is a little bit embarrassing, isn't it?
Well, it's an open secret that there's major drug abuse in the City of London. It's been going on for years. this, and it just shows how much drugs are at every level of society, they are to be found. And of course the real problem is the dirty money generated by the drugs trade is underpinning, there's quantitative easing and there's the dirty money from the drug cartels which have propped up the banking system. And there's a study by the UN Office on Drugs and Crime which came out in 2009 pointing out that without the dirty money from the drug cartels, the banks would have collapsed. And of course the HSBC were convicted of money laundering for the Mexican drug cartels. This begs questions about all of our attitudes towards drugs, health issues, social. You know, is it appropriate for people to be smoking drugs like this if it's in their spare time or whatever? We could all argue about that, but the real issue for me is the money. We are now dependent upon money printing and drug and dirty drug money to keep the financial system going. That's really unsustainable.
This is a bit embarrassing for George Osborne, Jeff, isn't it? His advisor quitting after this film has been taken of him.
I don't think you can blame the Chancellor for what his aides and advisors get up to.
I mean, surely he should be trying to make sure that there are reliable people around him that know what they're talking about.
Of course he should, but you know, Martin's just said, you know, the world and in London is rife with this. I don't condone it, and I think it's wrong. And you know, I just lead a very sheltered life here in Bristol and don't mix in that environment. But it is worrying that people at the heart of government are in that position, but we should never judge because we never know when comments like that can come back to haunt us.
Okay, I think it's our final story today, and the government is having a row over the ban on extremist speakers over on university campuses. This is in The Guardian, a coalition row about limiting free speech on university campuses to ban hate preachers has broken out, with the Tories saying the default position is now that any extremist speaker should be banned, given the potential damage they can do. Only trouble is, no one really seems to know what's the difference between an extremist and how you define it.
That's always going to be the challenge, isn't it? I don't think any of us would want people preaching hate in any environment. But actually, we also have to allow our students to regulate themselves and form their opinions. And it's a very, very fine line. But I think that with freedom of speech goes a responsibility to not offend. And if someone is causing offence by the statements they make, then at that point they should not be allowed to retain that freedom of speech.
But so I mean, I could say I've just taken offence at what you've said, haven't I? I mean, anyone can say I've taken offence. But anyway, Martin.
I think we've got to be very careful about this. We either have a policy of saying that certain things are not to be said, and that would include, for example, drawing cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad, or we say that people are allowed to say what they want to say, including, for example, that, as the Reverend Sizer suggested, the Israelis might have had a hand in the 9/11 attack. Now, in actual fact, there's loads of evidence to suggest that they did. Now, that's actually a factual matter, and I don't think he should have been told that he couldn't say it. Whether people agree with him or not is another matter.
So how about, how do you deal with this then, Martin?
Well, I'm a libertarian by instinct, so I would rather have, let's just have everybody say what they want to say, and then we'll have to live with the consequences. But if people say that they want freedom of speech, and they're going to have to live with the consequences.
Doesn't it mean,
so,
Jeff, freedom of speech, Jeff, doesn't that mean freedom of for people you completely disagree with their views?
Yeah, it does, and I have on occasion, and I will, I'm sure, in the future, defend the right of people to say something that I feel passionately against, because ultimately, I'm with Martin on that. The freedom to express an opinion is one of those fundamental things that generations have tried to defend in this country.
Okay, time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest. Conservative Deputy Mayor on George Ferguson's Cabinet, Councillor for Westbury-on-Trim, Jeff Gobb. After the Murdoch News, Mohammed Emwazi was a good Muslim lad until MI5 got hold of him.